Midlands Today with Tullamore Opel Church Road Tullamore. A new year? Get ready to go further with the new generation of Astra. Waiting for you at Tullamore Motors Opel. See tullamoremotors.ie.
When people in the Midlands want to talk, they talk to Will Faulkner.
Good morning. How's it going? It's rather wet and not exactly warm. So I've been away for 2 weeks in a slightly warmer place. Very lucky. And this is a culture shock. But thank you to Lindsay and to Aisling and to Ronan and to everybody who kept the chair warm while I was gone. Now, coming up today, Black Friday. Are the offers as good as they appear to be? Also, while discussing the rain, there's an orange weather warning in the southeast of the country and a yellow weather warning across much of the Midlands. We'll take a look at what you can expect. And in sport over the last 7 days, well, the World Cup in Qatar certainly is on the agenda from 20 past 11. When you call 0818 300 103 is my number. You can text, you can WhatsApp 083 30 10 103, powered by Lamb Brothers Toyota in Tullamore. Good to be back. Good to be back indeed. What's on the front pages today? Well, the Irish Times tells you how the wealthiest countries in the world have agreed to pay trillions, not billions, but trillions of euro in payments to the poorer parts of the world as part of the COP27 environmental deal. Also on the front of the Irish Times, organ donation. So at the moment, if you wish to donate your organs, you have to opt in. You have to sign the donor card. You have to carry the app. Whatever way you give your consent is needed. So what is being considered is an opt-out system, where you will be presumed to have given your consent unless you carry something saying you do not want your organs to be harvested and donated. And I suspect most people would be quite okay with that. And in my own case, I've never just taken the time to fill out the donor card. I have the app on the phone, all right. And there are many people who are soft approvers, it says. Are you one of them? Or would you have a difficulty with it just being presumed and assumed that you've no difficulty with your organs being donated? Anyway, that's front of the Irish Times, the Irish Daily Star. Inside Pedo's lair, it shows the house that is up for sale in County Louth, where jailed paedophile Declan Power planned to abduct a teenage girl. And then on the Irish Independent, staff in line for payout if firms unfairly refuse remote working. So the rules around remote working are being strengthened. Initially, when this was all prepared, employers had 13 grounds on which they could refuse you. It was really in the employer's lap. So they have revised the work-life balance bill. And it is expected that if you are to be refused on reasonable grounds, you will get compensation. So, now, are we moving too far the other way, employers might ask. On the Irish Times as well, the new study about 9-year-olds. What is it like to be aged 9 in Ireland now as compared to 10 years ago? Well, you will have fewer hobbies today, it says. You will read less. And you will probably own a mobile phone. 54% of 9-year-olds today own their own mobile, compared with 44% 10 years ago. I have a 9-year-old. She doesn't have a phone. She need not ask for one. It won't be happening anytime soon, Isabel, in case you're listening. She should be in school. Also, it says, the number of children taking part in sport has dropped from 44% 10 years ago to 34% today. Now, that's taking part in sport daily. And there are other activities too, such as music or dance lessons, which are not being taken up to the same degree as they were a decade ago. This is all according to the Growing Up in Ireland study, which you shall hear more about later. terrible case in Kilkenny over the weekend, as a 16-year-old girl was a passenger in a stolen car. Her father had pulled up to do some business. She was in the passenger seat, and then a man came along, Dale Fogarty, 37 years of age, from Clock in Castlecomer, and he stole the car with this girl in it, and subsequently the car was involved in a head-on collision with another vehicle, and Mr. Fogarty was killed. Three adults in the other car were all injured. This was a couple in their 40s, a man in his 60s. And unfortunately, the teenage girl suffered serious, serious injuries. And the Irish Independent reports the extent of those injuries are not yet known, but her family is at her bedside in Dublin, where she is having surgery. So spare a thought for them today. Elsewhere, over 6,000 people have been approved for a home care package. That is good news. Except 6,000 people who have been approved for this home care are on a waiting list rather than actually receiving the package. And is this because the system is jammed up? Well, okay. In 2022, there was a target to provide 24 million home care hours. By August, 14 million of those hours have been provided. So we are on target. The HSE, the state, is providing exactly as much home care as it thought it needed. Except they have grossly underestimated how much home care is needed. So if you're on that waiting list, it doesn't say how long you will be waiting. There seems to be a postcode lottery. So if you're in some parts of the country, the delay is less than in others. Either way, there's a planning issue here, and more money will be required. Bottom line, that's in the Irish Independent. Which also reveals, by the way, the country's most dangerous roads. Thankfully, they're not in the Midlands. I would avoid Sligo, though, if I was you. It has the highest rate of road fatalities. And the country overall has seen a 16% hike in the number of lives lost in traffic tragedies this year compared to last. Other dangerous counties are Monaghan, Limerick and Cavan, for whatever reason. Leo Varadkar is not happy about the roads, but for a different reason. Transport Infrastructure Ireland, which governs the tolls on the M50 in Dublin, it has announced a 9% increase in tolls from January 1st. And Mr. Varadkar is not happy about this. He tried to contact Transport Minister Eamon Ryan. He was unable to because he has been away at the COP27 climate summit in recent days. So says the Irish Times. Butchers are closing at a rate of one every 3 days, according to the Associated Craft Butchers of Ireland. Their president, Jack Malloy, is blaming electricity prices, which, as you know, have soared. Well, particularly in the last 18 months, but they've been creeping up for a long, long time. One butcher gone every 3 days. Black Friday is featured in many of the papers as well. Lots of advice, lots of questions as to whether the value is authentic. For instance, you might see something advertised at 50% below the RRP, the recommended retail price. But was it previously selling at the recommended retail price? Very often not. There's one outlet here which has been selling a telly at €400, and they say it was €600, but it was €600 2 years ago. So it's not a Black Friday reduction. It's been steadily coming down. Anyway, one more for you. Met Éireann has issued its yellow rain warning for most of the country. The heaviest, most intense rain will be in Waterford and in Wexford and in Wicklow. And you can expect that wet and breezy weather to intensify as the day goes on. But if you're planning anything this week, expect unsettled conditions, plenty of rain and showers. Temperatures will be about normal for the time of year, so not too bad. Mark has been in touch by email, studio@midlands103.com, and he is concerned about an advertisement he saw recently for a brand of car that drives itself. And he is pleading with the government and with the Road Safety Authority to immediately put legislation in place to ban the sale or use of driverless cars in any shape or form. He says, these cars are not fit for our roads and never will be, not to mention the insurance problems, the safety to pedestrians and cycles, and there's also a clear danger to emergency vehicles after a driverless car recently ploughed into a vehicle that had flashing lights. Mark says the time to act is now, not when these things become so widespread and the market is flooded, and these are powerful people who are unstoppable. He says, I voiced the same warning about social media back when it was in its infancy, the need for regulation. And now look at the monster social media has become. Look at how Twitter is treating its workers. And there is little we can do about it now without compromising jobs. He says, the RSA want safety as their priority. Now is the time to prove it. Nothing other than a total ban is good enough. Is he right? Because the prevailing wisdom is that in certainly a decade, we will have far more autonomy in our cars than is the case today. Already there are some brands that are able to steer on a motorway. They mightn't do it on a country road, but they can steer quite safely on a motorway, or so they say. And the feeling is, once this technology improves, they will actually be safer than the human driver, and it will be the human intervention that leads to accidents. And Elon Musk of Tesla says he's even putting cars on the road where the software isn't fully developed because he believes it's in the greater good. That even if Tesla is sued, and the reason they will be sued is the whole question of who's in charge, is it the car or is it the driver? But he believes they are safer and therefore lives will be saved if he takes that approach. I don't know, Mark. Wait and see. The technology certainly isn't ready yet. And one of the points you make very well is that sometimes we don't plan ahead when it comes to the law. Another example would be the electric scooters. It has taken so long to actually regulate them, and they've been around for years. And unless we take action, driverless cars, autonomous cars, yes, there will be a gap in the law. Anyway, 0818 300 103 is the Midlands 103 comment line. You can text or WhatsApp 083 30 10 103, powered by Lamb Brothers Toyota in Tullamore. Hilda would like to give a big shout out to retailers who raised the price of sugar from 95 cent to €1.25, just in time for the holidays, she says. Ina, you do not approve of young children having mobile phones, and it is silly on the part of parents. You have a 16-year-old, a 14-year-old, and a 12-year-old grandchild who, yes, own their phones, but time enough when they start secondary school, she says. Well, that is the question. Should a 9-year-old have a mobile phone? And a majority of them do, by the way. They are also less active in daily sport than their peers from 10 years ago. They are less likely to take part in cultural activities such as music or dance lessons. All of this information captured in the Growing Up in Ireland study. And to tell you more, Dr. Emer Smith is a research professor with the ESRI. Emer, good morning.
Good morning.
Just give us an overview of Growing Up in Ireland first, the background to the research.
Okay. Growing Up in Ireland has two cohorts, an infant cohort that we started with 9 months and have followed up most recently at 13, and an older cohort we started with at 9 years, and that will be 25 next year. So what we've done in this study is take advantage of the fact that we have those cohorts, both those cohorts at 9 years of age, but 10 years apart. And over a period of a lot of change, policy change, like the introduction of preschool education, the impact of the recession, other changes around parental leave, literacy and numeracy strategies in school, and so on.
And how much information are you tracking about them?
An awful lot. We speak to the children themselves as soon as they're old enough to do so. We talk to both their parents, and we talk to their school teachers and their school principals. So we have really rich information, and the fact that we follow them over time means we can look at how children change and develop.
So what have you noticed? I mentioned some of the highlights, but what stands out for you from the latest study?
What stands out for me is those concerning trends and some of those activities, the fact that there's a fall off in very regular sports participation. We see some decline in cultural participation like music and drama lessons. And we see some fall off in reading for pleasure among those who aren't the children of graduates, if you like, so among the kind of less advantaged groups. And that's of concern because those are activities that really promote children's broader development, their physical development, but also their emotional and their cognitive development.
And just to check, do you capture if somebody is reading on their mobile phone, or does it just record that they were using their mobile phone?
No, we ask them explicitly if they're reading for fun or for pleasure, and that included things like Kindles and reading on
okay.
their phone. It's sometimes difficult to make that distinction, all right, but we did include that, yeah.
So are you inferring that as children have moved more and more to use their phones, that's the reason they're spending less and less time reading?
There is a link. It's not the full picture. We do see that the children who are spending more time on digital devices, but even more time watching television, and those who have a mobile phone are less involved in the cultural activities and the reading. And there's also a trade-off with sports participation. But it doesn't fully explain the shift that we see. We actually see within screen time a shift from watching television to using other devices. But we mightn't be fully capturing, if you like, the full range of screen time. We ask about their main activity, but we're not really capturing, say, if children are on their phone in the back of the car going to school and that kind of thing. Mm. So it might be an underestimate. But it, what we see more is, rather than a complete increase in screen time, we're seeing a shift in how it happens. But that doesn't fully explain the other patterns we're finding. Some of it we think might be due to the effect of the recession. The younger group were born on the cusp of the 2008 recession. So their families would have been more under more strain when they're growing up. And many of these activities, like sports and cultural activities, they require payment. So if parents are under financial strain, that might be what they cut back on.
So have you noticed that those children in more well-off households are more likely to take part in the dance lessons, those cultural activities?
Yes, definitely. And we've seen that all along. There's a big difference by social background, but by gender as well. But what we see in the sports and reading patterns is that the social gap, the social background gap, has got a bit wider over time, and that's of concern.
Talk to us about gender, because again, if you think in the last decade, we've had brilliant female role models in sport, Katie Taylor just being one that springs to mind. So what's the divide between boys and girls when it comes to sport?
There's still quite a big divide. Girls are much less likely to take part in sport, but they're more likely to read for pleasure and engage in cultural activities. They also spend a bit less time on digital devices than boys. So really, we see that the kind of social worlds, if you like, of nine-year-olds are very gendered, and that really hasn't changed over the 10-year period. That we're getting kind of these gender differences emerging even early. When we looked at this group when they were younger, you see even differences around being read to a little bit and about engaging in sort of creative activities like painting, drawing. Mm. There's a gender gap even there at 3 and 5 years of age.
And how else do the girls and the boys tend to differ?
Girls typically have closer and less conflictual relationships with their parents. They're more likely to describe themselves as getting on very well with their parents. But they tend to have smaller friendship groups than boys, and they tend to see their friends a little bit less often than boys.
Hmm. That's a curious one. Again, this doesn't necessarily measure the why. It just captures what is happening.
Yeah.
And was that the case 10 years ago as well?
Yes, it was. What we see, actually, parents are describing their relationships with kids as closer than previously, but the kids themselves are saying they're you know, there's a slight drop in the proportion getting on very well, but the vast majority just have positive relationships with their parents.
Mm.
We also see a slight fall off in the proportion of families eating dinner together every day as a family.
By what degree?
It's a small, it's about a 5% drop, but the fact that it's moving in that direction just shows that kind of seems to be the impact of busy lives, if you like.
Mm. How many of us are sitting down for the family meal on a regular basis?
2/3.
Okay.
Every day.
Still the majority, which is good.
Yeah, still the majority, yeah.
Now, you mentioned the recession earlier. What is the impact in this study of financial strain or lack thereof?
Well, it has a number of impacts, but probably one worth singling out is that it really puts parent-child relationships under pressure, that we see there's more parent-child conflict where families are under financial strain. And we also see that children tend to have smaller friendship groups. So it's limiting what the children can do, but it's also putting pressure on the relationships in the family.
So here are the big questions. How to deal with these trends now that we know they're there? Economies, well, that's largely outside of most influences. But reading, for instance, to try and correct that trend, what's your advice?
Well, I think it's about early years provision. I think it's important that some of those gender differences are tackled early on and that you have a variety of engaging activities for girls and boys and across all the social groups. Obviously, schools are crucial and they have been doing a lot around reading for fun. Libraries as well have a very important role to play. I think around some of the other activities, I think we do need to be looking at more subsidised provision of sports and cultural activities for disadvantaged groups. I mean, you know, requiring payment is going to limit their access. Schools can play an important role, obviously encouraging physical exercise, but smaller schools are a bit more constrained about providing after-school activities.
Mm.
So we need community-based facilities as well.
Which, again, relies on some people in the community and voluntary sector having that time and that bandwidth to do You've conducted all of this valuable research, painted a fascinating picture. What happens to the report? What is it used for?
Okay. Well, this is part of a broader research program with the Department of Children, Equality, Disability, Integration and Youth. So that program is designed for us as researchers to work very closely with the department to feed research findings into policy. So they are looking at this, and the minister will be launching the report later today, and I think he'll be highlighting some of the early years provision and some of the rollout of things like the little libraries to try and encourage reading among very young children. But also the department play an important kind of coordination role with other government departments in around the lives of children and aspects of policy that affect their lives. So this would feed through to this. I mean, as always, like, you know, you don't have research findings and instantly everything changes. But I think the more we know about the lives of children and what, if you like, the pressure points are, the more we can target better facilities and services to address those.
Eimear, grateful for your time and thank you very much for taking our call.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Eimear Smith is a research professor with the ESRI. It's 20 to 10. Quite a few parents who have children aged 9 and even a few years older are somewhat bamboozled by the claim that a majority own their own mobile phone. Not on your Nelly would be a polite way of saying what some of these parents have said. And, well, let's give you the exact figure. 54% own their own mobile phone, compared with 44% a decade ago. So there is still a substantial minority who have not yet been given the mobile. Now, still to discuss today, if you are one of those unfortunate people who are being laid off in the tech sector, and Twitter and Stripe would be two of the major job losses here in Ireland, well, there may be some local alternatives. Details next. Now, just looking at A quote from Taoiseach Leo Varadkar over the weekend after it was confirmed Twitter will make 140 people redundant, and it took quite a while for the company to confirm those redundancies with his department. He says, "My thoughts are with the staff who are affected, which is just over one third of all staff in Dublin. They can be assured they will receive a lot of government support." And as for speculation that this may only be the beginning, and Elon Musk, the world's richest man, may lay off more people at Twitter, Mr. Varadkar said, "Look, I cannot predict the future. There haven't been any suggestions at this stage that there will be any more." So if you are one of those unfortunate people, if your livelihood is now very much in jeopardy, once you dust yourself down, once you're able to process it all, what should be your next move? Well, one place to consider, at least paying a visit to, would be the Web Mill Hub in Mount Mellick. And Paddy Buggy is the manager there. Good morning, Paddy.
Good morning, Will. How are you?
Very well, thank you. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, when I heard of this initially, I was going, oh my God, God help those people, because as someone who was made redundant myself many years ago, it's not a nice place to be. But having said that, what we want to do, I suppose, here in the Web Mill and the other hubs around the country and is we have to think of ourselves as facilitators for people. We're not just like a hotel where you get a bedroom. You don't get a desk in a hub. What we've tried to provide is contacts and networking opportunities for people. So what I was saying to people is, if they're in that situation and they're based in Naois, awfully close by, come into us. It's a location to meet up. We have facilities here that you can use as you plan your next phase of your career. You also have the opportunity for networking with other businesses that are here, because a lot of businesses have, I suppose, out offices, if you'd like to call them that, where they might have one or two people working in the different hubs around the county, and including ourselves here in the Web Mill. And through coming in and networking, you're getting to talk to other companies as well to see what opportunities are available. And I suppose the other way of looking at it too is, because we facilitate the presence for the likes of Laois Leo, Enterprise Ireland, the Laois County Council Business Support Unit, and Laois Partnership Companies, who hold kind of clinics here on a regular basis, we can arrange for if a group are coming in from either Stripe or Twitter to come in here, and we'll arrange for the people to come in and talk to them about what is available and what's not available. Mm. But we also have to remember, these are very highly skilled people, and these are skill sets that are of great benefit to the likes of businesses here in Laois and Offaly.
Well, for instance, digital marketing, if you are a good, if you've got creativity, if you've got graphic design skills, if you know how to make Facebook, Instagram, TikTok work for you or work for a client, then you will be in demand. And as hard as it may be to see past the trauma of redundancy now, there may well be entrepreneurial opportunities in this.
Absolutely, because if you take a town like Mount Mellick, for example, a lot of small businesses, very few of those businesses can afford to hire a digital marketeer full-time. But they can hire you for so many hours a month and pay you for so many hours a month. So you can create jobs for yourself that way and be based here in the likes of the Web Mill in Mount Mellick and use this as your base. And so you're right, there are opportunities for people who have those skill sets, and that can be replicated all over the Midlands. So there are quite a few job opportunities in the Midlands. You have to think slightly differently. You're not working for the one company. You could be working for 20 or 30 different companies every month and working on their behalf. So you become their technical expert behind the scenes that no one sees, but yet the benefits roll to those businesses.
Mm. And as you've said, there are supports for startups and indeed, if somebody wants to make that first contact with you, what's the best way to reach out?
Well, if they contact us on our website, www.webmill.ie, or they can phone me directly on 087-623-8268. And I'd be delighted to welcome them into the Web Mill here. And they can use this as a location, get themselves together, get their CVs and everything done up, and start applying online. But we'll also be bringing in the supports from the different agencies that are in the county here to help with them.
Paddy Buggy, grateful for your time. Thank you.
Thank you, Will. Take care.
Paddy runs the Web Mill Hub in Mount Mellick. By the way, if you're not in Mount Melick, there are similar hubs dotted around the Midlands, at Mount Rath, for instance, and, well, there are many more. I'm not even going to get into naming each one individually, but suffice to say, there may be more opportunities on your doorstep than you realise if you are one of those unfortunate people who have been laid off. But again, once the dust settles, it's a hell of a shock to the system, and not everybody will be able to dust themselves down and move on quite so quickly. Now, still to discuss today, is Black Friday too good to be true? What offers have caught your eye this year? If you've seen a good one, send it to me. The nurse who quit to join the circus. And how well can the Schlieve Blooms prepare you for Mount Everest? It's bizarre stuff on the agenda between now and 12. 0818 300 103 is my number. When you text or WhatsApp, it's 083 30 10 103. Serious business, though. Your help is needed to try and intervene as best as we can, as a society at least, with a former soldier, a man who is suffering PTSD, a man who has fallen on very hard times, and who has found himself homeless in County Westmeath. Now, his story is being highlighted anonymously by Circa Clark, the Sinn Féin TD in Longford Westmeath. Deputy Clark, good morning.
Good morning, Will.
Can you tell us more about this man and his circumstances?
Okay, I'm going to call this man Alan, okay, just to protect his own identity and the circumstances that have led to this. When we look at those who have come out of the Defence Forces, are veterans. These are individuals who have served the state. And in circumstances like those that Alan would have, he would be a man of an age where his past experiences have led him to a place now that he would have somewhat of a unique need, and a unique level of supports would be required. So while the state as such relies very much on the vets associations who are best placed to help with some of those supports, they're not best placed for others. So they refer on, but they refer on to services that may also be under pressure. So you've got the housing crisis on one hand. You've then coupled with that the unique need of those who have served the state, and as you referenced yourself, that element of PTSD that's there. But at the same time, you have somebody who is in receipt of a Defence Forces pension. So it gets very complicated very quickly, and there's an awful lot of doors that are closed and simply not enough that are open. Now, also, we would see this increasingly in my offices over the last number of months, I'd say since around the middle of summer, from also with younger people who are coming out of the care system, people who may be leaving home due to a marital breakdown, or people who may have addictions or substance abuse in their lives. So again, you have a very broken system that's then compounded by all these other factors in addition to that. And I am genuinely fearful, Will, for Alan at this point in time. He is physically in a place that he can't stay. He is emotionally and psychologically in a place that is incredibly difficult for him, and he needs help and he needs support. So if there is anybody out there in the community who may have some suggestions for Alan or the place that he can go to, my offices are willing to work with them. Alan has agreed that we will work with anybody and everybody out there who may be able to help in this circumstance. He is a man of an age. The weather, as we know, over the last couple of nights has really taken a downturn. That's to be expected to last now until well into the new year. So again, on Alan's behalf, I am putting that ask out there. If there's anybody in the community who can come and who is willing to work with him, with all of our support that we can give unquestioningly, please reach out and make contact.
So you say Alan is of an age. Again, Alan, not his real name. He's been out of the Defence Forces for some time, has he?
He has been out of the Defence Forces for some time.
Has he been able to find anything else to do?
No, not as of yet. He would have had employment for a period of time, but the situation that he's in at the moment hasn't been one that has emerged overnight. Mm. This has actually been something that has been developing since just before COVID, so nigh on 3 years now at this point. And the longer that this continues to go on, the harder it's going to be to get all of those supports at one time. And we do not need an individual like Alan bouncing around between various different services for another 6 or 9 months. That's just not acceptable.
Not to pry, but are there family who can help?
there would be, but at the same time, the effort that they and the help that they can provide is rather limited because of their own situation and their own circumstances. So there would be family. There's not a lot of them. It would be a smaller circle of wider family than what most of us would be used to. So again, the help that they can provide is limited. Firstly, simply because of their numbers, and then secondly, because of their own circumstances.
So is Alan on a housing list? Has he approached Westmeath County Council for assistance?
Yes, and he has been provided with emergency B&B vouchers, and this is another issue as well. And again, the impact on this, on somebody like Alan, is more profound. What we have seen over the last 4 or 5 months is people who are in receipt of B&B vouchers, yes, absolutely, the majority of the cost will be covered. However, the availability of these premises is shrinking by the day, and people are needing to move further and further away from their support network and their support structures, even their children's schools will, to be able to use these B&B vouchers. And like, if you bring this back to actually what the point of it is, B&Bs and hotels, their job is the tourist industry. Their job is not to provide housing. So even that is a short-term measure. Now, back when I was the county councillor, I would have reasonably expected somebody, if the need was there, to go into a B&B for a very short period of time. I am now telling individuals and families that if this is a step you need to take, I cannot give you a timeline. I can't, in all honesty, put any form of a timeline on how long these individuals and families are going to be there. So whether it's somebody from the Athlone area who may be going as far as Louth, if it's somebody from the Mullingar area going as far as Roscommon, I can't say to those individuals, yes, you'll have to come back in for 6, 7, 8, 9 months, whatever the case may be, in order to get your kids to school, to go to your GP, to go to work, whatever the case may be. I just don't know anymore.
Okay, let's park that bit for a moment. That's a huge policy question, but the needs of Alan are very acute right now. So a few people have asked, ONE, organisation for ex-service people, can they help?
Yes, and you see, they can certainly help, and there are other veteran associations outside of ONE as well. This Alan's circumstances are a little bit more complicated, and what I see happening, and what I would have feared happening, is that the conditions and the circumstances that led to his situation are now being heightened and worsened and compounded because of where he is at the moment. ONE are a wonderful group; they do fantastic work. So do the other veterans, but they are not the service that can predominantly help in this circumstances. There's multiple of them, possibly 3 services at this point that Alan needs to be able to engage in with. And as I said, if there is anybody out there who will be familiar with working with these circumstances and wants to work with Alan, please reach out.
Okay, and contact your office. Now,
or yourself.
Indeed, we'll make that connection, happily. Now, back to the issue of capacity, the bigger conundrum and the bigger headache. If you were on the other side of the door, what would you be doing now?
What needs to happen now, and actually Sinn Féin will be bringing a motion forward on Tuesday night in the Dáil, and this should have happened actually over a number of months ago. The government needs to declare a housing emergency, and there needs to be stronger interventions to close that gap between the needs of people and the provision of the state's responsibility for the provision of that services. If you've read the newspapers over the last number of days, you'll know that there's nearly 500 million of the government's housing budget for the first 9 months of this year has not been spent. Now, whatever about inflation and energy costs, when things like that happen, what we should actually be seeing, Will, is that money being spent quicker, not slower. How in the worst housing crisis in modern history is there an underspend across the board in the government's housing plan? 228 million not spent on local authority housing, 122 million not spent on the advanced lease and capital programme, 17 million behind on cost rental, 11 on affordable housing. I could go on. There is not one section of this government's housing policy that is working and that is delivering for people. And that is why we see the likes of the one-third of 15 to 34-year-olds considering emigrating in that recent Red Sea poll. The minister has said he doesn't think that there's a state of emergency. The minister really needs to read the room here, and he needs to see the struggles that people are facing morning, noon and night. 11,000 people homeless, 51% increase in child homelessness since April of 2021. Rents and housing prices have passed the Celtic Tiger ceiling, and they are
all very powerful numbers. But what do you believe is the barrier? Why is there an underspend when there appears to be the political will?
Well, if there was the real political will that's needed in this circumstances, what you would have seen is those barriers, particularly around the local authorities and the level of bureaucracy that exists there. That would have been one of the first things that the minister actually tackled, along with setting aside this budget. But fundamentally, if you look at any of these schemes, even the Croí Cónaithe scheme, that none of them address the real core issue, and that is the price of properties is just simply beyond so many people's reach, and that the entire generation locked out of secure and affordable homes is the result of that. But if this government aren't capable or are incapable of solving this problem, well, then it's not a change of Taoiseach that we need. It's a change of government, because that's what the people need. They need this issue tackled, and they need it seen it done before we lose one third of our younger population to emigration.
But how would that reduce building costs, reduce material costs, reduce property costs?
I was speaking with a couple of developers last week, and one of them specifically told me that the contract that they are currently on is coming to an end. If the state was to reach out to them, they would have absolutely no issue in working directly for the state to build homes on public land. They're ready, they're willing, they're able, they want to do this. But that approach has yet to be made to them. And that's just not on at this point in time. That really is disgraceful. The land is there. We know that's one developer in the Midlands I just happened to bump into and had a conversation with. They're willing to do that. Those types of developers have actually reached out to Eoghan Brin over the last number of months and said something very similar. So the state needs to activate the assets that they have there, and that would be the public land that they own. And they need to develop properties on that own, whether it's cost rental, cost purchase, affordable or social housing. And it needs to be done now. Well, we can't wait for a third of 25-year-olds to leave the country.
Circa Clark, I wish Alan the best. We'll keep in touch about him, and thank you very much for your call.
Thank you, Will. Bye.
Circa Clark is the Sinn Féin TD in Longford West Meath. Next, Black Friday and indeed Cyber Monday. Are the offers too good to be true? If you've spotted some genuine value, please do share. Are you excited for Black Friday? Have you got the checkbook ready? How old-fashioned, Faulkner? Have you got the credit card ready or the debit card ready? Does anybody write checks these days? Anyway, what sort of offers are available, and are they genuine value, or is it all just a bit of marketing? Conor Pope has written a brilliant article in the Irish Times today. Conor, good morning.
Good morning, Will. How are you?
Very well. Let's start with the origins of Black Friday, first of all. We call it a tradition, and as you argue, what counts as a tradition these days?
Well, I mean, it's a tradition in the United States. And in the United States, Black Friday makes a lot of sense because Black Friday falls on the Friday after Thanksgiving. So it's always the last Friday in November. And it makes sense in the United States because the vast majority of workers who don't work in retail in America have that Friday off. So it's like their equivalent of St. Stephen's Day in this part of the world. So a lot of people will go home to their families. They'll spend their day, the day, Thanksgiving Day, with their families. And then on the day after Thanksgiving, they'll go into the shops and buy whatever it is they need for Christmas. And American retailers have been using that day as a sale period for donkey's years, going back to the 1950s or 60s. But in this country, it makes absolutely zero sense. And it only really came to this country in 2014. But it started out in the United Kingdom because the Walmart-owned Asda supermarket announced a Black Friday sale in Asda shops around the UK in 2013, and people went wild for it, and there was literally riots in the supermarket aisles as people were fighting to get their hands on the cheapest tellies and all the rest. Now,
well, I think it was probably in the ether here even before 2014, in that, well, going back to the boom, people were taking trips to New York and such
exactly.
cities
now,
to
that's
avail
a really
of Black
good
Friday.
Point. Yes, so they were travelling to America to avail of the sales, and if you could afford it, and you wanted all that stuff and you liked shopping, well, more power to you. I'm not going to knock you for that. But it was very much an American thing. But it only became a thing in this part of the world in 2013, first in the UK, and then in 2014, when a lot of retailers in this part of the world, in Ireland, started rolling it out. And of course, retailers don't really like it, because the bottom line is that people are out spending money in the last week in November and the first few weeks in December anyway, and they didn't really need that added sale period coming so soon before the traditional sale period of the winter sales. But anyway, we are where we are, as the phrase goes, and it became a thing in 2014. An awful lot of retailers now feel like they have no option but to put products on discount in the run-up to Christmas. But of course, retailers aren't in the business of losing money, and they're not in the business of selling products that they could otherwise sell at a higher price at a massive discount if they can possibly avoid it. So I suppose that comes to your next question, is there value to be found? And the answer to that, Will, really is it depends. Because according to Which magazine, the British consumer watchdog magazine, 99% of products that it priced on Black Friday or Cyber Monday can be found selling for cheaper or at least at the same price at multiple points in the 6 months before and the 6 months after Black Friday. Now, so that all that really means is that the Black Friday weekend is a sales period, but it's like a bus. There's going to be another one coming down the tracks fairly quickly, although that would make it a train, as I say it out loud.
Yes.
There is going to be another sale period. So people shouldn't lose the run of themselves. And the other thing that I think is really important to make, is something is only a bargain or something is only good value if you need it. So if you go out and buy stuff that you don't need and probably don't want and maybe can't afford, just because it's advertised at 50% off or 40% off or 60% off, well, then it doesn't matter whether or not the sale or the deal is legitimate or not. You're still wasting your money. But if you can buy something that you actively need, like a fridge or a washing machine or a cooker, or indeed a nice three-piece gold shimmering suit, whatever it might be, if you can buy that on discount at Black Friday or Cyber Monday, well, then you might as well buy it at that period as opposed to paying full price the week before or maybe even the week after.
Let's talk about the advertising and the marketing, because sometimes the price will say RRP, recommended retail price, whatever it happens to be, priced today, Black Friday, this much less. But they were never selling at the RRP to begin with. Or they say, once upon a time, this was 1,000 quid, now it's 500 quid, but actually it was 1,000 quid 5 years ago. So what does consumer protection law say about this?
Well, under consumer protection law, you can't mislead a customer, but retailers are very canny and they know exactly what they're doing, and they would be very rarely found to have, broken the law. But if you say something or a recommended retail price, €1,000. Now, a product, let's say just take a random phone, right? Imagine a phone was released onto the market in 2020. And imagine it had a recommended retail price in 2020 of €1,000. And now you're selling it at €500. You can technically say 50% off, bargain phone, was €1,000, now €500.
Yeah.
So the question that the consumer needs to ask is, yeah, but when was it €1,000? And has it been €1,000 for much time before this particular sale period? So that's one thing that retailers can do. Another thing they can do is they can say, okay, we're going to charge €1,000 for this phone in June, July and August, when we know people aren't really going to be buying phones, for instance, right? They might be on summer holidays or whatever it might be. And then roll on November and they say, was €1,000, now €500, 50% discount. So that's just one thing that they can do to create an impression. Now, I'm not saying it's misleading, because it's actually true. The product was for sale at €1,000 and now it's for sale at €500. But the question that the consumer needs to ask is, well, is it for sale at €1,000 everywhere else? And am I, by shopping in Johnny's phone shop, am I getting a particularly good deal by paying €500? And the simplest thing you can do in that instance is you pick the product that you want, and you look and see how much Johnny's phone shop is selling it, and then you look and see how much Mary's phone shop is selling it, and Tommy's phone shop is selling it. And if they're all selling it at €500 and only one of them is offering it at a 50% discount, well, then you kind of know that you're being manipulated into buying a product.
Yes, but of course the staff in Johnny's phone shop, the original shop, will be trying to close the deal there and then before you do your research, saying, we've only got two of these left. There was a man exactly. in earlier inquiring about this one, etc.
Yeah, and that's why you need to be a little bit more canny about what you're doing. And that's why, actually, if somebody is going to be shopping in the Black Friday or Cyber Monday sales or whatever you want to call them, that's why they need to be doing their research like today or indeed last week or the week before last. So if you do, like, let's say you're in the market for stuff and you want to buy stuff. You don't just, you know, randomly walk into the shops on Black Friday with a shopping trolley and say, I'll have this, and this. Because that way you're going to end up paying more money than you perhaps need to for stuff that you maybe don't want. So, and again, I would say this to anybody during a sales period, you actively sit down and you almost treat it like you're doing your big shop on a Friday or Saturday or Sunday in your local Lidl or Aldi or Tesco or Dunnes or whatever it might be. You draw up a list of the stuff that you want to buy. And then you go off prior to the sale, as in today, and you price it in places. And then you can say, okay, well, I know that Johnny's are selling it for 500, claiming 50% discount. Mary is selling it for 600, but it's on full price. So is Johnny to be trusted? And you approach it like that. But the bottom line is that most consumers in Ireland are a little bit suspect of the Black Friday sales anyway, according to a survey that was carried out by the Competition and Consumer Protection Commission last week, or published last week. 65% of us don't really trust the deals on offer on Black Friday. And I think that speaks volumes about how retail works. And again, this isn't to have a pop at retailers, because an awful lot of retailers are really under pressure. They've just come out off the back of a two-year pandemic. And as soon as the pandemic was almost over, they went into a cost of living crisis. So people don't have, so everybody is feeling the pinch, but at the same time, you don't want to get the sense that you're being misled.
But just remember, it is a marketing device at the end of the day.
Of course. They're not your friend.
Some text.
No retailer is your friend.
No, well, some text that you might want to react to. Melanie says she lived in Burlington, Vermont, in the United States for many years. And she was always under the impression Black Friday meant it was the day in which retailers went into the black as opposed to into the red, the day they broke even and everything thereafter in the Christmas period is profit. True or false?
I had the short answer to that question is it depends on what you read. Because, I mean, I went and I found out the origins of the term Black Friday. And indeed, there are some sources which suggest that it was Black Friday weekend, or Black Friday was the day, as your listener says, that retailers went into the black, because for 10 months of the year they would trade at a loss, and then they'd make all their money in the last 2 months of the year, from the end of November until actually the last month of the year, from the end of November to the end of December. And there's certainly a truth to that. But another suggestion is that the word came from Philadelphia in the 1960s, when the Philadelphia police used to refer to it as Black Friday, because all of the people from the surrounding towns and cities and counties in Philadelphia used to descend on the city to do all their shopping on the day. So the streets were literally black with people. And then they used to all go to the Army and Navy football match in the town. So it was kind of, in the 60s, the term was coined for a lot of people. But then the actual phrase Black Friday goes back to the 19th century, when there was some kind of crash on the gold markets in America, and it became known as Black Friday because all these gold investors lost all their money. So the phrase Black Friday has entered the lexicon has been in the American lexicon for more than 100 years. It could have its origins in Philadelphia. It could indeed, as your Vermont listener says, or she's not Vermont now, it could be to do with profits. But I suppose the bottom line is it's just a catchy, easy to remember phrase that, as I say, makes sense in America, but doesn't really make a whole lot of sense in this country.
Just a final one from Jimmy. He says, when he was younger, Kolshi Shopping Day was a big deal. Has Black Friday replaced it?
Well, I'm glad because I remember that, because I grew up in Galway. I'm from Galway. And we used to always have December the 8th as the day. Now, I would never refer to the word Kolshi, because apart from anything else, my children were born in Dublin, and my wife was born in Dublin, and they call me a Kolshi because I was born in Galway. But that's neither here nor there. But we used to always have a thing in the west of Ireland, in Galway, where December the 8th, I think it was a feast day. Now, some of your listeners might remember their Christian doctrine or their Catholic catechism better than I do. I can't remember if it's the Annunciation or the Assumption or whatever feast day it was on the 8th of December.
It's the Feast of the Immaculate Conception.
conception.
I knew that. I didn't have to Google.
Well done. Well done, Will. Although that strikes me as, how does that make any sense? Because if the conception happened on the 8th of December and then...
Let's not go there. Let's not go there. Stick to consumer advice.
Conversation. That's an ecumenical matter. No, but it was a big tradition. The reason why it's such a big tradition is a lot of schools would be closed on December the 8th. A lot of people would be off on December the 8th. And as a result, people would do their big Christmas shopping. They'd come into the big towns and cities around the place and buy all their presents on December the 8th. Whether or not it still happens, I don't really know. It's certainly not certain. It's not something that you hear much about in Dublin. I don't know if you hear about it in other parts.
No, but I think it just shows that there are a number of benchmarks on the way into Christmas. It used to be maybe exactly. Just one. Now there are several. Cyber Monday as well, of course, in a week's time. Connor, I wear my Kulshi badge with honour. I think
so
you should
I.
too. Take care.
Bye.
Connor Pope is the consumer and trades correspondent with the Irish Times. Just after 25 to 11, and next, how well can the Schlieve Blooms prepare you for Mount Everest? In a few minutes' time, did you see unusual lights in the sky in County Westmeath last night? If so, well, I'd like to hear from you, but one lady's a little puzzled and she shall share her puzzlement very soon. Preparing to climb Mount Everest. Not necessarily to the very top, but any portion of it is a heck of a challenge. And here in Ireland, we just don't have mountains like that. So how effectively can you train in the Schlieve Blooms? Well, Robert McDermott is on the phone from Edenderry. Robert, good morning. Hello, Robert.
Good morning, Will. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So this is an ambition that you've had for as long as you can remember. Tell us more.
Yes, well, probably, yeah, as we all know, Edmund Hillary was the first guy ever to climb Everest, and I learned about that in history in school, and I always found it fascinating how he did it and how he managed to get up to Mount Everest back in the 50s, and anytime there was ever a documentary or a series on anything about Everest or climbing, I always kind of had an interest in it, but I never probably thought I would have get there, but the Nepalese people always were of an interest to me, and the Sherpas as well. Wow.
Were you a hiker? Did you try maybe to climb the Wicklow Mountains, the McKillicuddy Reeks?
I did the Wicklow Mountains in training. Mm-hmm. I also was up the Stairways to Heaven in Enniskillen, obviously up and down Crowpatrick, Crown Hill, but I spent most of my time in the Schlieve Blooms down in Kinnity. I found them very enjoyable. And used to go down there Sunday morning or Saturday morning early and probably walked around once or twice around the loop because you need about 4 to 6 hours walking every day when you're in Everest, so you need something to simulate that. So I used to go down there and behind the COVID mask and go walking to try to simulate the lack of oxygen.
Ah, yeah, very clever. And did
so
you find
a crazy guy down there that was going around with a blue mask?
Right. How did you find doing it with the mask? The lack of oxygen, did it impact you?
It's actually it is actually difficult, and it is a benefit to you when you get to Nepal. Because anything strenuous, I don't know if you try to do anything strenuous during the COVID time with a mask on, it is actually, you don't get the full breath. So it does, it gives you some idea, but lack of oxygen is definitely a whole new experience for Irish people. There's no really way of actually training for it until you actually arrive there and just experience it. And it gets people in different ways. Personally, it got me at night time. A couple of nights I woke from a deep sleep with a lack of breath. And that's a frightening way to
yeah, I don't
wake
say.
Up.
Let's fill in a little blank, though, in between the training and getting to the mountain. So having ticked this on the bucket list, you reached out, and I believe Pat Falvey was the man who led your expedition. How many of you altogether?
10 of us went in the group. I came across Pat Falvey during the COVID lockdown when I was doing research on the possibility of doing this. And he's brought nearly 3,000 Irish people to base camp in Everest. And he only had 2 people didn't make it. So I said to myself, this sounds like it could be done. And looking at his videos online, the people who were doing it looked like Ardy Joes like myself. So I said, here, I'm going to have a bash of this. And I reached out to all my mates just for a bit of company. And they had plans. See, a guy you went to college with put his hand up. And we took it, the challenge on together. And it was great to spend company doing the training, the long walks, somebody to talk to. So So it was enjoyable.
You need the positive reinforcement because you'll have your tough days. So anyway, the 10 of you board the plane in Dublin. You fly first to Istanbul, then onwards to Kathmandu. What was the plan of action once you got there?
We had to get the last minute gear. A lot of us needed sleeping bags. There was two of them for minus 10. So we bought those. Some of us, other guys needed some extra pants. You need this, there's special mountaineering pants you wear. You need a couple of those, a couple of T-shirts, base layer, a couple of thermals, a fleece. It's little enough gear that you need when you get there because there's not the Ritz Hotel you're going to, so there's no need to dress up. You're just in your house in your mountain gear and you get your smart wool socks and underwear and there. And a few woolly hats, a pair of gloves, warm jacket, and then pack it all up. And the Sherpas, in fairness, they do most of the carrying. They're fantastic people. I don't know how they do it. They get three or four bags, strap it onto their backs, attach it onto their head, and off they go. You know, they're gone before you in the morning with your bags, and your bags in your next tea house when you arrive. And they're fantastic people.
I know they're acclimated to it, but still, it's a formidable undertaking. So you get anyway to eventually on the second night, the famous Everest Hotel, and that offers your first view of Mount Everest. Can you capture that moment for us?
It's actually quite emotional. I'm not an emotional type of person, but when you see it, it actually is emotional because it's probably one of the icons in the world. More films made about Everest, more documentaries made about Everest. Like thousands of people try to get there, and very few people have managed it. It's to see the height of it is fantastic because a lot of times you can't see because there's a mountain beside it which is 100 meters less than Everest. So to even get to see it is unique because the clouds often are over it as well. So to get a good view of it we're very fortunate and very lucky. And eight of the highest mountains in the world are in that area, so you're surrounded by snow-capped mountains. It's quite an experience when you get there.
Do you feel isolated?
Yeah, you do at times, actually. Yeah, you really feel you're at one with yourself. You have a lot of time to think about life in general when you're walking. And it's very good because it's so quiet up there. There's no cars. There's nothing with a wheel up there. No cars. If you want to move, you got to either walk or get on a pony. So the life's pace is slow. And it's definitely good. No street lights or anything like that. So you have to walk during the daylight. And you got to make sure you're in your tea house before it gets dark.
And it's so alien in many ways because you describe on your way to base camp, and it took 8 days to get to base camp, just so people have some sense of that. You were looking down at one point and seeing helicopters flying below you.
Yeah, that is definitely one of the things I'll never forget. You realise, because you're climbing every day, you don't realise how actually high you get until you actually see the helicopters flying below you. You say, wow, this is, I've never seen this before. And the helicopters, they struggle up when you get close to the base camp as well because the air is so thin. They do day trips up there, I believe. I didn't take one, but they'll catch you and they'll fly you up to the base camp. And they take six, then they have to stop near enough to base camp and let three people off and fly those three and then come back and take the other three. The air is that thin.
Did you have any second thoughts as you're climbing up?
No, I did have two tough days as regards tummy upset. And that definitely tests your mental strength. But I was never going to let a doubt get into your head. If you let doubts get into your head, you're in trouble. You know, so like in the group, we're all strong because every day somebody was struggling. So we all pulled each other along. And we all knew that starting off. And the objective was for us to get there, the base camp, which we all achieved. The last hour going to base camp, I thought was a little nervy because the rocks under your feet weren't. They were shifting a little bit and you could hear the ice, the glaciers were melting underneath and you could hear the splashes of ice fall into the water.
That was a bit
unnerving.
I dare say when you're at that stage, you're 5,300 metres in the air. That's 17,500 feet in old money. It's a sobering experience.
It is. And there was one crew from Poland there with March, they were trying to get to the top, which at the time we were there was not really a time for climbing. But the guy who was doing it, he was trying to ski off the top of Mount Everest, which was fascinating.
I don't know. What do you even say to that? I suppose there has to be a first for everything.
Yes, yeah, so seemingly somebody had skied off previously with oxygen, but he wanted to do it without oxygen. He was camped too when we were there, and the weather was changed, so the kind of thought was he wasn't going to make it. But I never actually. I must find out if he did or not.
I hope he did. I hope he's in one piece. What's next on the bucket list, Robert?
And altitude. I'm not going back to altitude anyway anytime soon. But that was a once off. Dave and I and our wives are actually, we're keen to do the 32 county peaks in Ireland. I believe there's a book out that actually gives you the GPS coordinates for the highest point in every county in Ireland. Ooh. So I think that'd be a little challenge within a challenge. You're reason to keep up the training.
Well, Robert,
hopefully in the spring.
Best of luck with it. Yes, indeed, in the spring. Wouldn't take it on today. You'll be washed out of it. Bring the canoe. Thank you very much for the call.
Thank you, man. Cheers.
That's Robert McDermott from Edenderry. Good morning. Now, your sports update is coming at 20 past 11 today, and, well, we will inevitably have to talk about Qatar and all of the issues away from the pitch when it comes to World Cup 2022. That and the nurse who quit her job to join the circus. First, though, what's your morning, Sinead?
Good morning.
Terrible event in over the weekend. Can you fill us in?
So Dale Fogarty stole a car from Green Street in Kilkenny shortly evening. Now, there was a 16-year-old girl with special needs to this car.
Right.
There were reports that this car was seen driving dangerously on the N77 between Kilkenny City and Ballyragget shortly before it crashed into another car. Now, Dale Fogarty died in the crash, and his body was taken to St Luke's Hospital in Kilkenny. The teenage girl, she was seriously injured and was airlifted to University Hospital Waterford, and she underwent surgery on Saturday but has now been transferred to a hospital in Dublin. The people in the other car, there was a woman in her 40s and two men in their 60s, and they were taken to St Luke's Hospital where they're being treated for non-life-threatening injuries.
Yeah, I was reading that it was a father bringing the couple to a wedding at the time, so just compounding the sadness of this.
Yeah, and the dad of the teenage girl had just left. She'd been sitting in the car for just a couple of minutes while he popped into his office to collect something.
Dale Fogarty, why would his name be familiar to listeners in Durrow in County Laois?
So in 2012, Dale Fogarty was stabbed at an apartment in Kilkenny, and his friend Kieran Monaghan, who's from Durrow in County Laois, was also at the apartment, and he was stabbed, but he died from his injuries.
Yes.
So there was a major investigation launched at the time, but the suspect was not prosecuted because he claimed he'd been defending himself in his own home, and the defence was accepted by the Director of Public Prosecutions.
Of course, as we know, Kieran's family has long disputed that version of events and wanted a fresh investigation.
Yeah, and they've been campaigning for a number of years now for people to come forward, for people to say what they saw on that night. And now we know that Dale Fogarty won't be able to reveal what he saw, because he had never told what really happened that night.
Right. What do we know about him, Dale Fogarty himself?
So he has a number of convictions, and he had been living in sheltered accommodation in Kilkenny City. Now, he's a father of two who's originally from Castlecomer. It's believed that he may have suffered with addiction issues, and he's been described as a petty criminal who was well known to Gardaí.
Right. The bedside vigil continues. We understand the parents of that 16-year-old girl who remains seriously injured in hospital, and our thoughts are very much with them and with the others who were injured, and indeed with the family of Mr. Fogarty, who will be grieving his loss. Sinead, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we just want to make sure nobody has been taking any psychoactive substances, nobody had a few too many to drink. Were there unusual lights in the sky in County Westmeath last night. A few people have confirmed this, by the way, so it's not just one person who maybe was on the magic mushrooms. No, there was definitely something up. We will also be hearing about the World Cup in Qatar and your local sports results too with our sports editor David Hollywood. But first, a bit of a mystery. I want you to meet Violet in Bunbrosna in County Westmeath. Good morning, Violet.
Good morning, Will. You're welcome back.
Great to be back. Great to be back, and even better to be chatting to you. What has you puzzled?
Well, now, last night, I went out to put the cats to bed. The rescue kittens, and they're still asleep in the shed. And over the football pitch beside us, I could see these weird lights going round in a circle. And I couldn't see any source for them above or below.
So, were they coloured lights or white lights?
No, no, white lights. White lights, circular white lights. Like, I thought, grand, great little flying saucers.
E.T. has phoned home, yeah.
Oh, God, absolutely. He was coming to land in Bun football pitch. So I got in the car and drove out to the pitch, and I still couldn't see any source for the lights coming from up or below. And they seemed to move as I was moving. And so I thought, right, I'll drive up to the top of the hill of Rhéan, which is quite a high point out here. And when I got there, I could actually see there were some sort of strobe lights or something coming right up Monaghan direction. And that, and I'd just love to know what on earth. Well, I mean, somebody was obviously putting on a light show somewhere, but I don't. Belvedere haven't started yet, I don't think, have they?
Well, that is my first suspicion, and this is what I am checking at the moment, because the Land of Light is a big event taking place at Belvedere.
Yes.
And indeed, you can buy tickets for it, although it sounds as if you may not need tickets for it because you're getting a pretty spectacular show.
Oh, God, I was very excited. I rang the neighbours, a couple of neighbours who don't have money out here, and they could see some lights in the sky as well. But, I mean, it was really very, very weird, now, I'll tell you, honestly.
Well, look, the good news is
pattern.
You are not imagining things. We don't have to get the people with the padded coats.
No, because I was worried about that.
It is the Land of Light, which began on Friday the 18th of November.
Ah, right.
And continues until Friday the 23rd of December. And
well,
it is at Belvedere. And that, as you know, is not too far away from where you are. So,
the far side of Loch Ennell,
yes. I imagine it's more likely that than an alien invasion.
No, it wasn't the aliens, because I kept looking for, and I was hoping. I mean, you're always hoping, aren't you?
Well, what would you do? Would you invite them in for tea?
Absolutely. God bless us. Can you imagine the knowledge they would have? Yeah, wouldn't it be great, Greg?
Well, look, we'll knock on your door some night and see what happens.
Yeah, right. Try that one.
No, Violet, you can relax. You can rest easy. Land of Light in Belvedere, that's what has you puzzled.
No, well, I'd encourage people to go out and have a look at the night sky, and just, you never know what you're going to see. Yeah,
absolutely.
Go out.
Lovely talking with you, Violet. Take care.
Okay. Thanks, Will. Goodbye.
Violet from Bunbrosna. Yes, a few others seeing that. Even as far away as Moat, one lady has spotted it over the last couple of nights. So it must be quite a spectacle if you're at Belvedere itself, and there's music and there are other attractions as well, all built in. Oh, the plot thickens. So, yes, it's probably the lights at Belvedere, but a listener in Carlow says, well, I've seen a white light travelling at night at different times here as well, and Carlow and Belvedere are not exactly next door. Will, I've spotted the lights at Dysart in Ballinay, says Martina. Yes, you wouldn't be a million miles from Belvedere. Indeed, Ina says she saw them last Monday. They only started on Friday. Interesting. And in the Rosemount area, we've seen those lights and we're nowhere near Belvedere. These lights were in one place, were not moving. So maybe it's Belvedere, or maybe E.T. really is around. Either way, we have a bit of a mystery, and I assume the people at Belvedere can answer those questions.
The Monday Sports Review, brought to you by Slater Kia, introducing the new EV6 fully electric SUV with a range of over 500 kilometres. Find out more at Slater Kia Mullingar.
Our sports editor, David Hollywood, is here. Morning, sir.
Good morning, Will.
We shall start with Gaelic Games, the Leinster Senior Football Championship semi-finals. Plenty of local interest.
There was indeed. There was a tantalising prospect of a Midlands derby for the Leinster final. It eventually did not come to pass. The Downs upheld their part of the bargain by winning the first semi-final by 2 goals and 12 to 17 points against Rathoath, who had dispensed of Road prior to that in the quarter-final. Kilmacud Crokes, however, well, they steamrolled Port Arlington, 112 to 4 points. We'll get back to that in a bit. But let's have a look at the Downs. This was an excellent performance. Niall Mitchell scored a crucial second goal after 40 minutes. The Downs put on an exhibition of hard running. They're actually a pleasure to watch in terms of their style. It is one of the more uplifting things to watch in Gaelic football at the moment. Their fitness at that stage looked absolutely superior. Then Andrew Kilmartin, he got a red card in the 56th minute after a cynical pull earned him a second yellow card. He had a quality game up to that point. But once they were down to 14, Rathoath started to assert themselves over the Downs. Larwall's side went 10 minutes without a score. They looked tired. Crucial moments, though, they make victories in an injury time with a point between the two sides. Luke Loughlin, he took the ball down the touchline. He ran down the clock. But ultimately, ultimately, Rathoath did have a chance at equalising this. Dara Egerton fouled a Rathoath player wide on the touchline. Jack Flynn had that chance to level the game with the last kick of the match. And unfortunately from his perspective, fortunately from the Downs' perspective, it went wide. Luke Loughlin was man of the match, played brilliantly. We're going to hear from him shortly. He scored 5 points, set up three as well. It's a first Leinster final since 1972 where they lost against St Vincent's. Can they go one better this year? We're going to find out in a couple of weeks' time, which is an absolute thrill to look forward to. Larwall, as I said, is the team's manager, was watching on from the sidelines, and he was not in a happy place when Jack Flynn was lining up a potential equalising free in those final minutes. Here, he's talking to Jerry Russell.
Listen, the last free, it was just, I had, I suppose, flashbacks of just, you know, we were 5 or 6 points up, and I just couldn't believe we'd got ourselves in that position. And it was always going to be, once the ball came up that end of the field, it was a free. And listen, it was a very tight angle for Jack, but at the same time, you know, it was just, he just pulled it. And it was a very difficult free, to be fair to him. But, you know, sometimes it's your day, and it was our day today, I felt.
That very tight game all through. You went 3 points up. Kieran got the goal, put you in a comfortable position. You were three up heading to 3 minutes of half-time. They scored three, I think four unanswered points at that stage, and we didn't level at half-time. Were you disappointed with that?
Yeah, we were, because we felt we had, I suppose, the upper hand, and especially in the second quarter. And just the last few minutes, we allowed them get shots off, and I suppose, yeah, we were disappointed. It was a half-time, we would have been kind of content enough to go in with the game just hanging in the balance, regardless. You know, whether you're three up or three down, you still have to face into the second half with the same attitude. But it's probably smartened us a bit. I think the third quarter, we certainly pushed up on their key men, and in particular Jack Flynn, and Dottie McGowan was doing a bit of harm on the scoreboard. So we kind of went man-to-man on them and got a bit of a squeeze on them, and I suppose released our forwards a bit better in the second half, and we got plenty of chances. Now, we didn't take the ball, but listen, we got a bit of a... Our third quarter was very good.
Just that period before half-time, you lost every kick out at that stage. Charlie got a bit injured as well. That wasn't a help either, but McGowan was spot-on with his scores.
Yeah, no, in fairness to Charlie, like, we done our absolute best trying to get him on the field. He was patched together, regardless of his head injury. His leg was kind of taped together, so we got a great shift out of him. But yeah, no, we were under serious pressure, and I suppose Dottie McGowan kicked serious scores just before half time, and we had to kind of try and curb that somehow. We did more or less in the second half.
And Luke Loughlin is the club's joint captain. As I mentioned, he had a great game, and he spoke to Aisling O'Reilly about his leadership role within the club and the changes in his life over the last 12 months.
I'm the oldest on the team there, on the starting team of 27. So we're just making our own bit of history, you know, and every day is just another. Everything's a bonus at the minute, you know, and we're just so enjoying it, and training's great, and long may it last, because I don't plan on going back to Westmeath for too long. For the slog, but look, I'm just repeating myself. It's just so special, a special club with special people, and to be at the forefront, joint captain with Mark. Mark doesn't say too much. I do kind of a lot of talking, but which is a shock, I'd say. But just so happy, you know, and try and take it all in now and just really enjoy tonight. A few seven ups and yeah.
You've changed your life, you know. Obviously, I knew you from your New York days. Yeah, we had some good times over there. And obviously, then you've changed your life completely. And look at you now, like what you're achieving. It's amazing. Yeah.
It's just it's all those cliches, hard work pays off, you know. Joe Nangle, the S&C for Westmead, last November told me that I wouldn't see the benefits of the work I'm after putting in until the end of the club championship and on since then. And that's some prediction for him, you know. It just shows what he's about, you know. And just hard work, you know. Like, confidence comes from preparation, and that's exactly where my confidence comes from, you know. I do a lot of work, and obviously nerves come too, but you deal with them, and you've a great team around you. I've total belief in everyone that plays with us. You know, sometimes I mightn't perform and someone just steps up straight away, and look, life's going great. Can't complain, you know. So.
Now, let's move on to the Port Arlington Kilmacud game, because unfortunately the prospect of a tantalising Midlands derby was not to be.
Not to be indeed, Will. Unfortunately, Port Arlington were not a shadow of a match to Kilmacud Crokes on this occasion. They ran them close last year. Kilmacud Crokes ultimately were the All-Ireland beaten finalists in this championship. But on this occasion, they steamrolled Port. Crokes slowed the game down right from the start. It was a really interesting, deliberate, tactical approach. We're going to hear from Port Arlington's manager shortly, Martin Murphy, and he alludes to just how well prepared Kilmacud Crokes were. They packed out the middle of the pitch because it seems like Port Arlington very much like early direct ball into the middle and final third of the opposition's pitch, but Crokes had that completely snuffed out, and Port Arlington were left kind of without an idea on the pitch. It was really hard to watch. You know, 4 points across 60 odd minutes of football is a desperate return, and it wasn't even like it was such a low scoring game, as Crokes in their very conservative way scored 112. Martin Murphy, he did join Pat O'Sullivan after the game, and they sifted through the ashes.
In fairness, we came here with high hopes and just didn't perform on the day. We've no excuse. Far outplayed by a far better team. You know, they controlled the game. Once they got the goal and got the sniff of 3 or 4 points ahead of us, they were in full control of the game, and we just couldn't get back into it, in fairness. Words fail me, really. I'm very disappointed. I can't really put my finger on what went wrong, whether it was a psychological thing or what, but we just didn't perform today.
Yeah, and look, and that's not the Port Arlington team we know of old, or all this year and the last few years, because, and it's disappointing, I suppose, when it comes that this certainly won't mark your, you know, your few years with them and the team themselves. Yes, I'm sure you're bitterly disappointed, but look, you've given great, great entertainment to people, but that was some machine, Kilmacud Crokes, and certainly that's what they were. They were a well-oiled machine that really had their homework done in it.
Look, they came up a few seconds short of winning an All-Ireland. Yeah. In fairness to them, they really done their work on us and they had us to a T. Not disparaging our own lads, but by far they were a far superior team than us today, player for player, pound for pound. If we were boxers, we'd been knocked out after the first round. Be honest, that's the way it felt at halftime.
That's an easy way to picture it. Unfortunately, not the day out they had hoped for. Let's move on to the World Cup, which got underway in Qatar yesterday afternoon. As you know by now, a controversial choice ever since it was selected as the host country in 2010. It is upon us now, and odd to be talking World Cup in November. Yeah. But anyway, here we are. How has it gone?
That's a big question. So we'll just start with the football first, because there was a football match. It wasn't supposed to be on yesterday, but Qatar decided that they would be on their own on the first day, which was one of many changes they've made to the plan since 2010 and their awarding of the tournament. So they ultimately will be relieved to emerge from the opening day with a 2-0 defeat, which doesn't sound great, but ultimately there was a gaping chasm between the two sides. Ecuador scored one goal in the last five games on the way to the World Cup, four consecutive nil-all draws, I think. So if we think it's hard watching Stephen Kenny's Republic of Ireland, Ecuador will have been driving their own fans mental.
Okay.
But with the carrot that they had a World Cup to look forward to, and they've started off great. Enner Valencia scored both goals. They were 2-0 up after 31 minutes. A composed penalty sent the keeper the wrong way, and then an excellent header. It was a thunderous header. The goal scoring did stop there So that, I think, can be considered a win for the Qataris, who, as a host nation, will be just hoping to save face on the football pitch. And their fans conducted a mass, and not organised, but a mass walkout at halftime. And a lot of the seats were empty in the second half. So whether or not they're getting with it in terms of engaging with the World Cup is open to question now as well. I don't know what they expected. This is a very small footballing country, and it would have been a massive shock if they do win any of the three games that they have scheduled as things stand. In terms of matters off the pitch...
How long do you have?
Yeah, exactly. We don't have long, so let's try give everybody the very best of what's on offer. And we're going to start off with FIFA's president, his comments on the eve of the World Cup, Gianni Infantino.
Today I feel Qatari. Today I feel Arab. Today I feel African. Today I feel gay. Today I feel disabled. Today I feel a migrant worker. I know what it means to be discriminated, to be bullied as a foreigner in a foreign country, as a child. At school, I was bullied because I had red hair. It's not easy every day to read all these critics for decisions which have been taken 12 years ago when nobody of us was there. And now everyone knows that we have to make the best out of it, and we have to make the best World Cup ever. I think for what we Europeans have been doing in the last 3,000 years, around the world, we should be apologizing for the next 3,000 years before starting to give moral lessons to people. This moral lesson giving, one-sided.
So, a lot to unpack there. Off you go.
Thanks, Will. Appreciate that. Hospital pass, I think, is what they call that. Why is he speaking that way, I suppose, is the first thing to answer. The reason is the pressure he, as the figurehead of FIFA, has been under in the build-up to this tournament has been extraordinary, on the basis that it is a tournament like no other. It's in November. They did promise a Summer World Cup with air-conditioned facilities and stadia so that everybody could enjoy themselves, and ultimately the weather is so inhospitable during the summer in Qatar that you might have an air-conditioned stadium, but people would be dead on their feet when they go home. Mm. That type of thing.
You've got so that went, by the way. So
gone. Forget about it. Can we please have a November World Cup? So that was accommodated for. Then thereafter, they promised an experience that the Western culture football fans, for want of a better description, could identify with and engage in. And all of this has really been stripped away and peeled back policy by policy. Silent rule by silent rule. A testimony from those who play football in Qatar or work in Qatar to say a lot of this goes unspoken, and that's why people are worried about if you're going over as a gay person. Yes, the speaking heads, Gianni Infantino or the likes of he, say it's fine to go over, but the laws say differently, and they are reported to really prosecute these laws in severe effect. Then
other evidence, beer and Budweiser, who are one of the big sponsors.
This is a huge one. It's quite funny on one level, but also it just goes to show how off-piste the people who run Qatar are willing to go. That the title drink sponsor for the World Cup has been told in the build-up, and this contract would have been nailed down a long time ago. Mm. You can serve your beer exclusively around the stadium. Now, that was taken away about 48 hours before the World Cup started. They just said, no, you're not going to be going anywhere else for a World Cup, and we don't like the sound of it, to be honest, so we're not having it. And that was the way it is. Other things that have been banned.
Although arguably Budweiser got more for their sponsorship than they could ever have hoped because of that.
Yeah, there is an element of that at play, of course, as well. And they will still serve the Bud Zeros at that stadium where no other drinks are available, as it happens. They're also banning the likes of nudity. So the topless English fan may be a thing of the past for this particular tournament. One I think is probably a shame.
that could be debated.
Yeah, well, it's a hallmark of a tournament, you know.
One thing I like, the Vuvuzelas, and they were just so annoying.
Terrible.
Wasn't it South Africa?
South Africa 2010.
Yeah. So having no more Vuvuzelas, I say that's a good thing.
100% agree with you on that one. I do like the unique sound of a World Cup. Every time you turn the TV on every 4 years, it just has a different din to it. And 2010 was like an outlier in that respect. It was awful. But this game yesterday certainly had a certain sound to it that I thought was different. Anyway, you won't hear Vuvuzelas. The big issue for the long period that these stadia have been built over the course of the 12 years is that there have been many migrant workers who've died in Qatar over the 12 years. We don't know 100% for certain how many, nor do we know what they were doing when they died. None of that information is available, but the likes of Amnesty International and several international publications are leading with 6,500 migrant workers at least, which is a ridiculous average of 12 migrant workers each week since 2010. And, you know, Qatar is approximately the size of Dublin plus a bit of Leinster. It's a terrifying statistic.
Indeed,
in that respect.
Yes. Yes, and the inference is these people may have died building stadia.
I find it very difficult to believe that there was much else going on in the city that wasn't related to the World Cup that led to this influx of migrant workers and subsequent number of migrant workers who died. So it colours everyone's perspective heading into the tournament. You'll try watch the football, but you'll also probably be conscious of what's going on around it.
Let's move on. The Republic of Ireland, pretty underwhelming at the Aviva, against Norway on Thursday and Malta on Sunday.
Yeah, underwhelming in both parts. Ireland and Norway, they were both fairly poor during the week. Ireland probably deserved a draw on the balance of play, but they conceded two extremely poor goals in each half. The first was headed in by Leo Ostergaard, who evaded John Egan in the box, and Alan Brown hammered in an equaliser. That was a very good goal, actually, only for Ohi Omijuanfu to put away the winner after Ireland failed to clear their lines from a Martin Odegaard free kick. Then yesterday, talk about after the Lord Mayor's show, the World Cup opener is on Irish television. The next programme is Ireland v Malta in Valletta, and it was nil all at half time, and you're thinking, this is purgatory. Like, this, Ireland fans have done something here that really is, it means that they've to be put through something. They did win. Callum Robinson scored the only goal of the game midway through the second half. A collection of poor performances to wrap up what's been a generally disappointing year for the Republic of Ireland. Stephen Kenny, if he does not start his Euro 2024 qualifying campaign in good fashion in March, pressure will be very much on. And I would say, just personally speaking, for the first time, if the pressure is applied after a couple of bad results at the start of the next campaign, it's very much justified, because the crucial thing when you play young players in progressive football is you see progress, and there wasn't much this year.
Quarter to 12, we better get our skates on. The November series next.
It's a clean sweep for Ireland in the November series. They beat South Africa, the world champions, in the first game. They beat the Pacific Islanders, Fiji, in the second game. And then they were 13-10 winners over Australia in the third game. Usually that's a brilliant series. You've beaten two quality sides and you've beaten Fiji, who can on their day cause teams trouble. No performances were very good. This game, Ireland-Australia, was 3-3 at half-time. Tells you all you need to know about it. It finished 13-10. It was scrappy. They missed Jonathan Sexton, who pulled out through injury very late. Other than that, they continue winning. So whilst they didn't play as well as they did on the tour in New Zealand, nowhere near, in fact, they still found a way to win against some very good sides. So if they can continue the winning habit through the Six Nations, then you would hope that the World Cup looks like a decent prospect going forward. But we know not to get too excited about that kind of thing.
Rory McIlroy is European number one. Shane Lowry enduring a frustrating week in Dubai for the DP World Tour Championship. Take us through it.
It's hard to get your head around golf sometimes. It feels like the season's ending and then there's another season-ending tournament. This is on the European Tour this time, or the DP World Tour. Lowry and McIlroy started the tournaments in similarly patchy style, but McIlroy improved throughout the weekend and Lowry basically stayed at that same level. He finished in a tie for 23rd, did Lowry. He's world number 23. Yeah, he can do better, but he needs to find an extra gear going into next year, it has to be said. Rory McIlroy, strength to strength, shot 71, 68, 65 and a 68 on the last day, means that he finished in the top five, and he's crowned European number one for the fourth time in his career. He also is the PGA Tour number one, and he won the World Tour, or the World Rankings number one as well. So it's been a remarkable year for McIlroy. The Masters is very much on his horizon, Will.
All right. Final comment from John McNamara, originally from Athlone, now living in Saudi Arabia. And he says, the citizens of the Gulf states, Kuwait, the UAE, Oman and Saudi, are passionately behind the World Cup. And he says, if you ask the opinion of ordinary people in the region and what it means to them, they will tell you. It's very easy to judge when you are 6,000 kilometres away. And he notes the contrast, because Russia was the host country the last time out, and that was after the annexation of Crimea.
It's a very valid comment.
Absolutely. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Will.
David Hollywood, our sports editor, back again at 1 o'clock. How do you react when your daughter announces she's leaving her steady job as a nurse to join the circus? Well, let's meet Kira Gray, who is an aerial performer with Circus Gerbola. Kira, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. Very well indeed. This wasn't exactly a spur of the moment decision. When did this interest in the circus develop?
I suppose I loved going to the circus in my teenage years. I used to always drag my family members with me to the circus when it came to town. So I always loved like sitting there and experiencing the circus. But I think for me, the thought of a career in the circus started the very first time I tried aerial acrobatics.
At what age were you then?
So it would have been in 2015, so I think I was around 21.
Now, this was also at the same time you were training to be a psychiatric nurse.
Yeah, so I was in college in what was Waterford Institute of Technology at the time, studying psychiatric nursing, and a group of us went to Dublin for the day just to try aerial. So we did the aerial silks, which are the two pieces of fabric that run from the ceiling to the ground. And I could not understand how people were actually climbing. It's so much more difficult than it looks. But I think back then the seed was planted and I was really up for the challenge.
But initially, plan A is still to pursue nursing. And is this more a hobby? Is it an interest? Or was there a secret plan hatching all along?
So there was a secret plan hatching all along, but obviously I couldn't really say it. I was still only in second year of college at that time, so there was still a good bit to go. But I did actually tell my lecturer one day that I wanted to join the circus, and he kind of looked at me a little bit funny. But he was really nice, and he gave me the benefits of sticking with nursing, and then kind of helped me figure out that maybe the path I should take for now was nursing, and then when I was more experienced, look towards a career in the circus.
But how did you eventually build up to telling your family?
Honestly, I think I just did it and I told them after. I went to them when I had the opportunity ready. And I was like, this is what I'm going to do, because I know they would have been completely supportive. They've always been really supportive over the years. But there was a little bit of fear that, you know, that this wasn't going to work and that they were going to have to dig me out of a hole. But luckily it all came together and it's been really good.
So how do you prepare for a career in the circus? I mean, obviously physically then you have to work on your body or your core strength, all of those things. But the practice, the training, where does that come from?
Yeah, so there's a couple of places in Ireland that do offer training for aerial acrobatics. And for me, living in Wexford at the time, Dublin was the closest. So I travelled to Dublin 3 to 4 times a week to get the training. And then back in Wexford, I had loads of like local personal trainers who were actually, they were really, really good. They would research how to train someone for aerial, and they would help me out when I was in Wexford during the week. So it was a really unique experience.
So then to get into the industry, and perceptions are always wrong, but my perception is that the circus can be a bit of a closed shop. It's people who have family connections or who know people, and it's not easy to earn their trust and to get into that inner circle. What was your experience?
So I reached out to ISACS first, and they are the support and advocacy network for the development of circus arts in Ireland. And they offer some opportunities for artists where they link in with circuses like Circus Jerbola. And I joined Circus Jerbola as part of a residency opportunity. So it was an opportunity that was supported by ISACS, run by Circus Jerbola and funded by the Arts Council. So I got to go and live and tour for, initially at the beginning it was 5 weeks, just to get the experience of circus in Ireland.
Let's talk about your first big performance, because you've pressure on you in so many ways. You've taken a big risk. You're going out on a limb in every sense. So walk us through those moments, that pressure.
The first performance that I did in the Big Top, I remember everyone was so nice backstage. All the other artists were so supportive, and like they literally walked me through everything, where I needed to stand before I came out. And I remember going through the curtains the first time and out into the ring. And I just, at that time, I suppose it was maybe an experience as well. All I could think of was the steps of what I was about to do. So it's like, this is what I'm doing first. This is coming next. And I didn't really have time to enjoy it as such, if that makes sense, because I was so concentrated on what I was doing. But as I went through the shows, the more times I did the act, I really started to enjoy it and to listen to the music and to actually look out for people in the crowd and like see, make out little kids' faces as they're looking up at you. And yeah, it was a really, really great experience.
And when you see that awe and that wonder on a child's face, it must give you immense pleasure. Is there any part of you still questioning your decision, or are you at peace with leaving nursing?
No, I don't question my decision, and I am at peace with leaving nursing. I don't think I'll say I've left nursing completely. I would be more than happy to put on my scrubs and go back when time will let me go back. I really did love my job as a nurse. But it's definitely the kids' faces. It kind of reminds me of what my face might have looked like the very first time I seen them. I've seen any sort of acrobats do aerial in a ring. And yeah, it really is. It's a great feeling.
Well, it's been a wonderful story. Thank you so much for sharing it. Tara Jerbola, we know quite well here. She's originally from Port Arlington in County Leash. What's she like to work for?
Tara's lovely. She's been a great support.
Great stuff.
She's become my second mommy.
Ah, brilliant. Kira, best wishes. Thank you for the call.
Thank you so much.
That's where we leave it today. The programme was put together by Sinead Hubble and Chloe Farrell. And we will do it all over again tomorrow morning from 9. Have a great Monday. Bye-bye.